a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel just like a... That's folk singer and activist Richie Havens with Freedom, a song he actually improvised while performing at the famed Woodstock Festival in upstate New York in 1969. Other artists were delayed in getting to the venue, and it fell to Havens to keep things going until they got there. He held the crowd for almost 3 hours and became an instant cultural icon of the peace movement. Havens died of a heart attack on April the 22nd, 2 years ago. He was 72 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Last week, when the nation observed Constitution and Citizenship Day, a day officially commemorated since 1940, I thought it an opportune moment to remind you that these two things, the Constitution and citizenship, are tied together in a way we seldom are told or even expect. Much of the tone of the 2016 presidential race, as you know, centers on so-called American values, essentially how and what we think and who and what we are as a society. But one case, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1857, proved then, and still proves to this day, that neither the Constitution nor citizenship was meant to be a benefit to all Americans. The case known as Dred Scott v. Sanford held that African Americans specifically, whether enslaved or free, were neither meant to be beneficiaries of constitutional rights nor beneficiaries as citizens. Legal scholar Paul Finkelman, who teaches constitutional law, legal history, and race in the law at Albany Law School in New York, is presented here discussing the constitutional origins of the issue of citizenship in a detailed examination of the landmark Dred Scott case. This actually is a class he's teaching law students on the Dred Scott case. It is part two of his presentation, and you may want to check PRN's archives for part one, which aired on September the 17th. Today we'll hear about the legal strategies and wrangling that Scott, enslaved at birth in Virginia in 1795, had to endure to secure his freedom and the freedom of his wife, Eliza Irene, and their two daughters, Eliza and Lizzie. Why is this case important? Why should you know about it? Because it is the formal articulation by the nation's highest court, no less, of the answer to the still roiling question, who is a citizen of the United States of America? Professor Paul.
In any event, Dred Scott goes back to Missouri, and in 1846, he attempts to purchase his freedom for himself, his wife, and his now two daughters. The question of where would he get the money to purchase his freedom is easily answered. Remember Peter Blow. He has a couple of sons, and he now has a... He's dead, of course, but he has two sons, and there is a son-in-law, and the two Blow brothers and their brother-in-law get together and offer Dred Scott enough money to buy his freedom, and then he can pay them back gradually as he works. While this is going on, the Scotts, of course, are still working for Irene Emerson. She refuses to allow them to buy their freedom. Why does she refuse to allow them to buy their freedom? Because she says that she needs them. And of course she does need them in the sense that she is a middle-class widow in a slave city, and she needs somebody to help run the house. Imagine what it's like to have a house in a town where there's no running water, no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no indoor heating. Everything is done by intensive amounts of labor. And so she needs Harriet. If you think about the way women dressed in the 1840s with hoop skirts and whalebone corsets, you need somebody to help you dress. So if she lets the Scots get their freedom, then she simply has to buy other slaves. And why buy other slaves when you have two perfectly good slaves already? In 1846, then, Dred Scott sues for his freedom. His suit is based, of course, on the Somerset decision and on a huge number of decisions by the Missouri Supreme Court, all of which say the same thing, all of which say that if you bring a slave to a free jurisdiction, that slave becomes free. The only exception is if you're simply briefly passing through the free jurisdiction for a day or two. The case begins in 1846. It is delayed because, and this is again one of the bizarre ironies of the case, he sues Irene Sanford Emerson, and Irene Sanford Emerson says, well, I don't own Dred Scott. And Dred Scott doesn't have a witness to prove that she owns him. So the irony of the case is he loses his case, and he's remanded to the person who claims she doesn't own him. He then has to go to the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Missouri Supreme Court rules that he's entitled to a new trial. And at the new trial, which finally takes place in 1850, it takes a while. There's a cholera epidemic. There's a big fire in St. Louis. Justice grinds slowly. In 1850, a jury of 12 white men sitting in St. Louis declares Dred, Harriet, and their children all to be free. Dred Scott has won. And this is absolutely consistent with a series of Supreme Court decisions in Missouri going all the way back to 1824. The problem is that year there is a new constitution going into effect which has an elected Supreme Court. The elected Supreme Court leads to a sea change in the politics of Missouri. You get a court with two pro-slavery fanatics on the Missouri Supreme Court out of the three justices. The other is only moderately pro-slavery. And in 1852, the Missouri Supreme Court reverses Dred Scott's freedom in Scott v. Emerson. In that case, the court is frankly and openly political in the outcome. It says, times are not now as they were when the former divisions on this subject were made. Times are not now what they were when the former decisions on this subject were made. Since then, not only individuals but states have been possessed with a dark and fell spirit in relation to slavery, whose gratification is sought in the pursuit of measures which whose inevitable consequence must be the overthrow and destruction of our government. Under such circumstances, it does not behoove the state of Missouri to show the least countenance to any measure which might gratify this spirit. So essentially what the Missouri Supreme Court is saying is that because there are abolitionists in the North, and because some northern states free visiting slaves, precisely, of course, the way Missouri had done, and because there's opposition to the new fugitive slave law of 1850 in the North, Missouri should change its laws because otherwise it is giving support to this anti-slavery movement. And Missouri isn't going to do that anymore. At this point, the case should have been over. Dred Scott's gone to the highest court in Missouri, and he has lost. Before I continue, are there any questions about all of this? Okay, then let's go on. It should have been over because there's no way to appeal. There's no general federal question jurisdiction at this time. And Scott is just out of luck. except for the fact that a new twist occurs. While the case is being litigated in Missouri, after he wins in the jury trial, but before the case goes to the Missouri Supreme Court, Irene Emerson moves out of Missouri, moves to Massachusetts, falls in love for the second time in her life with another physician. She apparently likes being a doctor's wife. This man's name is Calvin Chafee. Calvin Chafee lives in Springfield, Massachusetts. He is an anti-slavery man. He will eventually be a Republican congressman, of course, and this is the time in the 1850s when the Republicans is really the only viable anti-slavery party in America. And so Mrs. Chafee now has a bit of a problem. She's married to a man who is a committed opponent of slavery, and yet back in Missouri, she has four slaves. She never tells her husband about this. I can only imagine, the second or third night after they're married, "Calvin, darling, I have a little confession to make. I know you're an abolitionist, but guess what? You now own four slaves through me. You don't own them, but you control them through our marriage." She never does that. Instead, what she does is to sell the slaves to her brother, John F.A. Sanford. John F.A. Sanford, like his sister, was originally from Virginia, had moved to St. Louis, where he married into a very, very wealthy old French family, the Chouteau family. In fact, there's a major boulevard in St. Louis, Chouteau Boulevard. Then it was involved in the Chouteau businesses, which included fur trading and various other enterprises. And he moves to New York and is essentially the New York agent for the family business. He is now the owner of Dred Scott. Dred Scott now has a new lawyer. It's his fourth or fifth lawyer in this saga. The new lawyer is a man named Roswell Field, who is from Vermont, and therefore has grown up anti-slavery. It's not clear why Roswell Field moved to St. Louis. I mean, one reason was because he had opportunities to do so, and people move to where there are business opportunities, where there's commercial opportunities, where a young lawyer can start out and do well. But it's also a slave city. It's surprising he didn't move to Cincinnati or, Springfield, Illinois. But instead, he moves to the bigger city of St. Louis. And Roswell Field comes up with a clever lawyer's theory. He says, well, if Sanford lives in New York, then he's a citizen of New York. And if Scott lives in Missouri, then he's a citizen of Missouri. And now we have diversity of citizenship. And the one easy federal jurisdiction in the 19th century, as today, is diversity jurisdiction. I know you all took civil procedure and you're all, just diversity jurisdiction just comes off your tongue in a moment's notice. But let me briefly remind you. Basically, the Constitution says that the federal courts have jurisdiction between over suits between citizens of different states. Somebody in this class is from New Jersey? No? Is anybody here not from New York State? You're from where?
Tennessee.
So if I go out of the parking lot and you ram into my car and damage it enough to get into the federal minimum jurisdiction, which is not likely with my car, but nevertheless, if we're in some kind of accident, I could sue you in federal court or you could sue me in federal court because you're a citizen of Tennessee and I'm a citizen of New York. On the other hand, if one of the New York residents, citizens, and I have this traffic accident, we can only be in state court. That's simple diversity jurisdiction. So Roswell Field of Vermont, now living in St. Louis, says this is a diversity case. Dred Scott's a citizen of Missouri suing a citizen of New York. And he sues for a huge sum of money. He sues for $10,000. He sues for assault, battery, and false imprisonment. Now, why is he suing for $10,000? Not because he thinks he's going to get $10,000. He'd be happy to get 50 cents. He is suing because the $10,000 gets him way over the $2,500 jurisdictional amount to appeal to the Supreme Court. So he sues Sanford for $10,000. Sanford responds with what's called a plea in abatement. It's an old common law plea. And what he says is to abate the case, that is to stop the case right here. It is kind of like a summary judgment motion. What Sanford argues is that Dred Scott is not a citizen of Missouri, as alleged in his declaration, because he is a Negro of African descent. His ancestors were of pure African blood and were brought into this country and sold as slaves. And so what Sanford argues is that Dred Scott cannot be a citizen of Missouri because he is black, because he's African American. Now, you notice the plea doesn't say Dred Scott cannot be a citizen because he's a slave. Because that, of course, is the substance of the lawsuit. You can't plead to the court and say, well, I should win on whether Dred Scott's a slave because Dred Scott's a slave. That doesn't get you anywhere. So what Sanford essentially says is even if he were free, even if he's not a slave, he has no standing to sue because the diversity clause says citizens of different states. Now, there are two ways of thinking about this. One way would be that Sanford should have won his case right then and there. That the federal district judge, who is also a Virginia-born slave owner, a lot of Virginians had moved out to Missouri, the federal district judge should have ruled that under Missouri law, black people are not citizens of Missouri, even if they are free people. That is, there are a lot of free people in St. Louis. St. Louis has a pretty large free black population. But what is the status of these free blacks? They can't vote. They can't be members of the militia. That's in part because of Missouri law, but also because of federal law. But under Missouri law, they cannot vote. If they move into the state, they are required to register with officials, whereas free white people are not. They have to pay special taxes. They are not allowed to go to school. They are not allowed to, in fact, be taught to read and write. They may not hold a number of professions. They may not be doctors, lawyers, gunsmiths, pharmacists, anything that would endanger the community. And so the argument would be that if you look at the totality of Missouri law, you would reach the conclusion that a free black, whatever that person is in Missouri, is not a citizen of Missouri. Now, we have problems, of course, by understanding what does it mean to be a citizen. If you look at the U.S. Constitution, by the way, the first time there's a definition of citizen is in the 14th Amendment, where it says all persons born or naturalized are citizens. Before that, citizenship is entirely left up to the states. The Constitution talks about citizenship, but citizenship is always within the context of state citizenship. The right to vote, for example, if you look at the right to vote in the Constitution, the right to vote is only for members of Congress, and it says, you know, that the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors in the most numerous branch of the state legislature. In other words, if you can vote for the state House of Representatives in Missouri, if you can vote for a member of the New York Assembly in New York, then you're entitled to vote for a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. That's the only voting qualification in the Constitution. Otherwise, voting is entirely left up to the states. So issues of race, gender, economic status are all controlled by the states at this time. So the question of what does a citizen mean is not entirely clear. For example, at various times and in various states in the 19th century, aliens are allowed to vote. In a number of states, the ruling is that if you are an alien who hasn't yet met the requisite number of years to become a citizen, but you've declared that you will become a citizen when you've been here long enough, you are allowed to vote. This is a theory based on the notion that what does the legislature do? It taxes people. What did we fight the revolution over? Taxation without representation is tyranny. It's unjust. Right? The Boston Tea Party is about dumping tea into the Atlantic Ocean because of the tax that was going to be paid on the tea, and the Americans weren't represented in Parliament. By the way, I mean, one of the oddities about the modern Tea Party movement is they would not be understood by the revolutionaries, because the revolutionaries understand you have to have taxes. Government has to be supported. Government may legitimately tax you if government represents you. Which is, of course, very different than the claim today that, oh, we shouldn't be paying taxes even though we have a representative government in Congress. So there's kind of a very big cleavage here between the use of these historical ideas and modern politics. But for the 19th century, the idea of citizenship is not very certain. There's no definition of it. So how do you determine whether Dred Scott's a citizen of Missouri? One way is to look at the totality of regulations, the totality of rights that a person would have. And when you look at the totality of rights for a free black in Missouri in 1854, you could make the claim that free blacks in Missouri are not citizens of Missouri, whatever else they are. That's one way of handling the case. The other way to handle the case is the way the federal district judge, Judge Wells, handles it. Judge Wells looks at the world and decides that there are essentially four categories of people in America. There are citizens, there are aliens, there are slaves, and there are Indians. And every person in Judge Wells' world has to fit into one of these four boxes. Dred Scott an alien? No. Indian? Clearly he's not an Indian. So there are only two possibilities. Dred Scott is either a citizen or he's a slave. There's no other fifth category of free, non-citizen, non-alien. And so he lets this case go forward because the case is going to determine whether or not Dred Scott is a slave or not. So Dred Scott sues for assault and battery, and then what happens is kind of a classic set-piece dance that takes place whenever a slave sues for freedom. Having lost the plea and abatement, Sanford then goes into court and says, it is true that Dred Scott alleges that he was beaten and held against his will and assault and battery. Sanford comes in and says, I moderately chastised Dred Scott. You know, each one is putting his own spin on the case. I moderately chastised Dred Scott, but I have a right to do that because he is my slave. So now he's entering simply a classic demurrer. Yes, I held Dred Scott against his will. Yes, I beat him or chastised him, but I have a right to do it because he's my slave. Therefore, this assault and battery suit can't go forward. Dred Scott's response is to say, no, you have no right to do this because I'm actually free. At that point, the judge says, well, on what basis are you free? And Dred Scott says, well, I'm free on the basis that I lived in the Wisconsin Territory, which is free under federal law, and therefore I am free. And so then they switch from the assault and battery case to the test of Dred Scott's freedom. If Dred Scott wins on the freedom issue, then they go back. And of course, because he's lost on his demur, he's lost the case. Sanford's now lost the case. Sanford then pays damages. And in these cases, normally, whatever the asking price would be, the damages are usually $1 or $10 or sometimes $100. And the slave goes free. That's the point. However, here, Dred Scott loses because the Supreme Court rules that the federal district judge rules that it must by the way, just to confuse you all further, remember earlier in the class we learned that the federal district judge is also the circuit court judge? Because of the jurisdictional amounts here, it's technically in circuit court, but it's the district judge sitting as the circuit judge who's hearing the case. So it's technically the circuit court for the District of Missouri, not the district judge, district court, but it is the district judge. So in any event, he rules that Dred Scott is still a slave because he says the federal courts have to follow state law. This, by the way, is the ruling based on Swift v. Tyson, and it's sort of an Erie Doctrine ruling, right? That the federal courts have to follow state law. Erie hasn't been decided, but it's the same kind of principle. We have to follow the state law unless there's a federal common law or a federal statute that says otherwise. So he says, since the Missouri courts have decided Dred Scott's free, not free, because the Missouri Supreme Court said Dred Scott's not free, we have to follow that precedent, and we side with the owner. Now, again, the judge might have made a mistake here. The judge might have come to a different conclusion. He might have said, we would happily follow Missouri law, except the Missouri court got it wrong because Dred Scott went to a federal jurisdiction. And he might even have made this kind of distinction. He might have said that when Dred Scott was in Illinois, he doesn't become free when he comes back to Missouri unless Missouri decides he's free. Because Illinois and Missouri are equals, right? And so Missouri can tell Illinois, I'm not following your rules. Now, the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution doesn't come in here because Dred Scott did not get a decision when he was in Illinois. If he'd gone to an Illinois court and won his freedom, then Missouri would be obligated to follow it under full faith and credit. But all Dred Scott is doing is saying, I gained my freedom by being in Illinois. I want the Missouri court to grant me that freedom. The federal judge in Missouri could easily say, sorry, Missouri has a right to ignore Illinois law unless there's a compelling full faith and credit issue. But the other claim of Dred Scott is he got his freedom up here, which is a federal territory. And the federal judge might have said, Missouri's free to ignore Illinois because they're equals. It's not free to ignore the federal rules because the Supremacy Clause says that the laws passed under the Constitution are the supreme law of the land, and every state judge must take an oath to support the supreme law of the land. So what he might easily have said is Dred Scott wins because he became free up there in the Minnesota Territory. But he doesn't. And then Dred Scott sues. Then Dred Scott decides to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court because he has now his diversity issue. The case is argued in the spring of 1856. And at the end of the term in 1856, the court decides not to issue an opinion. Instead, it holds the case over for re-argument. Now, 1856 is a presidential election year. So one could argue that the reason for not deciding it in 56 is because they want to wait till after the election, because they don't want to influence the election, or because they want to wait till after the election so that the election can't be an attack on their decision. Or it could be that the court simply feels that it needs more information from the attorneys because it asks for re-arguments on very specific questions, including whether or not the Missouri Compromise is constitutional. And now what I want to do is switch from this court history, this sort of the litigation history of Dred Scott, to a brief discussion of the regulation of the territories and the Missouri Compromise, because we can't understand this case without it. So I want to go back to this map, free and slave areas in 1821. Any questions before I continue? I mean, I've been shoving a lot of things, including civil procedure, down your throats, and I know that may be unpleasant. Okay. So, after the American Revolution, the United States ended at the Mississippi River. and everything west of the Mississippi, all of this was Spanish. It will later be taken over by the French, and we will later buy it. In 1787, the Congress passes the Northwest Ordinance, which says that this area is all free, and by implication, this area, Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi, Alabama, this will all be open to slavery. So basically, at the time of the founding, we have a nation that's going to be half slave and half free, with the possibility that more free states might come in from the Northwest than slave states. Then, of course, in 1803, we purchased Louisiana, which consists of all of this area, what is called unorganized territory here, Missouri, the Arkansas Territory, and the state of Louisiana itself. So all this becomes part of the United States under the Louisiana Purchase. The Northwest Ordinance had said that there will be slavery, neither slavery nor freedom, north and west of the Ohio River. Now, the Ohio River, as you can see, dumps into the Mississippi right there. When Louisiana enters the Union in 1812, nobody questions it coming in as a slave state because it's way south of the Ohio River, and there were tons of slaves in it when we purchased it. In 1819, when Missouri tries to come into the Union, the northern members of Congress object to Missouri coming in as a slave state, claiming that Missouri is south of the southern boundary of the Ohio River. Most of it's south of, here's where the Ohio River ends. It's south of the Ohio River, and it's also west of the Ohio River. Southerners, of course, are aghast at this and kind of throw up their hands and say, how can you be this dumb? The Ohio River ends at the Mississippi, and therefore the Ohio River has nothing to do with what is west of the Missouri. I mean, one of them says, by this theory, you know, we could extend the Northwest Ordinance to China or across the Pacific Ocean. If it's just everything that's west of the Ohio River is free, it's all the way around the world. Clearly, that doesn't make any sense. The debate is ultimately about political power. Do you want to have another slave state come into the Union or not? The House of Representatives passes a Missouri admission with no slavery. The Senate, where the slave states and free states are equally divided, rejects this because in the Senate it's always possible to get two or three or more northern senators to vote with the South. And so you have a stalemate throughout 1819 and into 1820, which is finally resolved by Henry Clay, who's known as the Great Compromiser, the congressman from Kentucky, who's later a senator from Kentucky. And Henry Clay comes up with the Missouri Compromise. Missouri Compromise says that Missouri will come in as a slave state, but all of the land north of the 3630 parallel, which is the southern boundary of Missouri, except for this tiny little thing called the Boot Heel, the southern boundary. So everything north and west of the southern boundary of Missouri, all this and all this, this will all be free under the Missouri Compromise. So, in addition, Maine, which had been a county of Massachusetts, breaks off from Massachusetts and becomes, and is a free state. So you get a free state and a slave state, and the promise, a vast amount of territory open to freedom, and not much open to slavery. The only thing that's left for slavery is the Arkansas Territory and Florida, which is still not a state. The South accepts this because it's in their best interest to do so, because they want Missouri to come in right now. Furthermore, if you look at the compromise between Missouri and Maine, you know, Maine, as you know, has very few products other than ice and snow and the ability to take pictures of moose. Whereas Missouri is a very large and very profitable and fast-growing state. And, of course, if we look at them today, Missouri has a giant population compared to the Maine population. So the other way to look at it is the South getting a pretty good deal. It's getting a lot of potential in Missouri. The North's getting a tiny little state in Maine. It may be physically big, but there's not much space to live in it because it's mostly forest. And at the time, anyways, before there's a tourist industry, it's considered basically uninhabitable. So that becomes the debate until, and now I'm going to move to one more thing, until 1845, when we annex Texas. And suddenly we get this gigantic empire for slavery, bigger than any other four or five states combined, gigantic place. And Northerners are upset with this because, of course, this means that the South now has more political power with the potential for thousands and thousands of people moving in, with many members of Congress coming in. And furthermore, Texas reserves the right to subdivide into a number of other states, so you can get more senators as well. Texas annexation leads to a war with Mexico because the Mexican government refuses to recognize its Texas independence, and because we aggressively insist that when Texas became an independent state, its southern boundary was about here. And we aggressively insist that the boundary is the Rio Grande. We send troops along the Rio Grande. We entice Mexico into a war. Mexico seems perfectly willing to go to war with us because it's good for the politics of the government of Mexico. Both sides are fairly aggressive, although the Polk administration seems far more aggressive than the Mexican government is. Mexico loses dramatically, which is a surprise when you think about it, because if nothing else, the American supply lines are enormous. They have to invade, you know, hundreds of miles of Mexican desert just to get to places to fight in Mexico. But the Americans win a very dramatic victory, and the result of that victory, of course, is to acquire all of what is called New Mexico territory here, all of the Idaho territory, Utah territory, which includes, of course, pieces of modern-day Colorado and Wyoming, all of California, so a lot of territory. This leads to a stalemate in Congress from 1847 to 1850 over what will happen to the Mexican territory. In 1846, a congressman from Pennsylvania, David Wilmot, proposes what is called the Wilmot Proviso. It's a proviso on an appropriations bill saying that slavery will not be allowed in any territory acquired by the Mexican War. The Wilmot Proviso is debated basically from 1846 to 1850. We get nowhere, and finally in 1850, the Compromise of 1850 is passed. What the Compromise of 1850 does is to admit California as a free state, giving the North 16 free states as opposed to the 15 slave states. But it opens up all of the New Mexico territory and all of the Utah territory to slavery. So while the immediate advantage is to the North, the long-term prospect is that you would get New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, possibly Colorado, possibly Wyoming, open to slavery. And in 1850, the historical record was very clear. Every territory where slavery had been allowed ended up becoming a slave state. If you let slavery in, you can never get it out. And so the Southerners are looking at this and saying, we're going to get all this territory and we will get a number of slave states. Then, in 1854, so this is 1850, the other thing the compromise includes is the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which is dramatically unfair and leads to enormous hostility in the North because of the nature of the law, which denies alleged fugitive slaves anything that resembles a due process hearing, including prohibiting them even from testifying in their own defense at a hearing as to whether they're a fugitive slave by saying, hey, you got the wrong man. Or the wrong woman. And so the result is that there are a number of riots in the North rescuing fugitive slaves from federal custody. Then in 1854, the U.S. Senator from Illinois, Stephen A. Douglas, wants to sponsor the building of a railroad from Chicago to San Francisco. And the route from Chicago to San Francisco would go Chicago, St. Louis, across Missouri, across Kansas, right into San Francisco. This would be the Transcontinental Railroad. This will make Chicago the great railroad hub of America. Chicago is by this time one of the fastest growing cities in America. It's Douglas's hometown, and this is what he wants. In order to get this bill passed, he has to have the support of the Missouri senators, including Senator Atchison. And, of course, Senator Atchison is a name that is tied to railroads, as in what he later becomes the head of the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe Railroad. So railroads are big business, big deal. Atchison agrees to building the Transcontinental Railroad starting in Chicago, going on to St. Louis, if Douglas will support opening up what's known as the Nebraska Territory to slavery. And the Nebraska Territory is all of this plus what's called the Kansas Territory here. So all of this is now open to slavery under the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. So, while Northerners had thought since 1820 that this would always be free territory, now they've discovered that it's going to be slave territory. Furthermore, remember the Missouri Compromise line? The 36-30 parallel? If you follow that across the country, the Utah Territory should have been free under the Missouri Compromise line. One thing to have done in 1850 was to simply extend the Missouri Compromise line across the continent. So this would have been slave territory, and this would have been free territory. They don't do that. They open it all up to slavery, and now in 1854 they've opened this up to slavery. And this leads to the most dramatic political revolution in American history in terms of party politics. The Whig Party collapses. The Democratic Party, which is the party of slavery because it's dominated by Southerners, has enormous internal conflict. And most Whigs join a new political party that is initially known as the Anti-Nebraska Party. But unless you're, you know, like a football fan from Kansas or something, or Oklahoma, you don't really want to be known as the Anti-Nebraska person. So eventually it turns its name into the Republican Party. And the Republican Party goes from basically not existing until the spring of 1854 to having enormous political clout and power by 1855. A number of sitting governors who are Whigs become Republicans. A number of members of Congress simply say, I'm now a Republican. And in 1856, Republicans teaming up with an anti-immigrant party known as the Know-Nothings have a majority in the House of Representatives. In 1856, they run John C. Fremont for president. Fremont, of course, is a national hero because he is known as the Pathfinder. He is the man who made the maps to get to California. He's a Western explorer. He had also been the leader of an American invasion force that, as soon as the Mexican War began, Fremont and about 50 or 60 of his mountain men, full bearded, fully armed guys, kind of dropped out of the mountains and seized Sacramento and then seized San Francisco for the United States. He had been a senator from California as soon as California became admitted to the Union, and now he becomes the Republican candidate. Fremont campaigns on the platform of free soil, free labor, free speech, Fremont, or free soil, free labor, free speech, free men. And of course, the free speech is part of the problem that Southerners did not allow debates over slavery in the House, in the South. So Fremont campaigns. He carries 11 states. Now remember, there are only there are 15 slave states and 16 free states. He carries 11 of the 16 free states. This is an enormous success for a brand new political party. He does not have enough to win the election. He loses the election because he fails to carry Indiana, Illinois, and Pennsylvania, which are the most conservative northern states, and he doesn't carry them. But he has an incredible showing. Now, that is one way to look at the political issue that confronts the court when Tawney gets the case in 1856 for the second time, when the court gets the case for the second time in 1856. The other way to look at it, which is, I think, how Chief Justice Tawney looks at it, is this, that in 1850, the Congress voted to open all of this up to slavery. In 1854, the Congress voted to open all of this up to slavery. In 1856, there was a presidential election, and the single issue of the presidential election in 1856 was, what do you do about slavery in the territories? What do you do about all this? And guess what? The guy who supported slavery in the territories won the election. So Tawney's way of thinking might be this, that as of 1856, the only places where slavery is not allowed is in the Oregon Territory, the modern-day states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and the Minnesota Territory, the modern state of Minnesota plus a little bit of the Dakotas, right? Everywhere else, slavery is legal. And the country has voted on this. The country voted in 1850, country voted in 1854, country voted in 1856 to allow slavery in the territories. So from Tawney's perspective, the issue of slavery in the territories has been settled except on the margins, except on a couple of places. And what he might do is clean up the whole issue. So the case is argued in the spring of 1856. No decision is rendered. The election takes place. Buchanan wins the election. Buchanan is the pro-slavery northerner from Pennsylvania. And then the case is re-argued in December 1856 after the presidential election. And no decision is announced. And no decision is announced. And no decision is announced. And finally, on March 4th, 1857, the new president is inaugurated. And James Buchanan, the new president, gets up to give his inauguration. On his way to the podium to give his inaugural address, Chief Justice Tawney stands up, the two of them shake hands, and they talk for a minute. Republicans will later talk about the whispering between Tawney and Buchanan. Now, in fact, they're old friends. They've known each other for their whole political careers. They are both graduates of Dickinson College. I once gave a talk at Dickinson College, and the night before the talk, I had a dinner for in the president's. The president threw a dinner for me, and there were like 20 or so people from the college, and they asked me to say a few things, and you know, I hadn't anything prepared, so I said that it was kind of daunting to be here at a college that has produced the worst president in the United States and the worst chief justice, and you know, they've never invited me back to speak there, so I thought they would have gotten over it, but maybe not. In any event, they're both graduates of Dickinson College. They're longtime political friends. Probably Tawney gets up and shakes his hand and says, you know, James, this is just wonderful. You know, we've waited our whole careers for this. Isn't it great that we two old men are now going to run the country? But Buchanan gets up and he gives his inaugural address. And in his address, he says that the major issue before the country is the question of slavery in the territories, and he says that is a judicial question. Now, keep in mind the history I've just given you. Since 1787, Congress has passed one law after another regulating the territories. Congress has never thought it was a judicial question. No president has ever thought it is a judicial question. They have always said it's a political question, it's a legislative question. Buchanan says, no, it's a judicial question, and he says, and I am sure everybody will agree, as I do, that we will abide by whatever the court decides. Now, later, Republicans like Abraham Lincoln and Salmon Chase, who will succeed Tawney as Chief Justice, will make the claim that there was a conspiracy between Tawney and Buchanan, so that in his inaugural address, Buchanan says everybody should obey the Dred Scott decision, but that when he got up there, Tawney told him what the Dred Scott decision was going to be. And so he, in a sense, has secret information that no one's supposed to have, because we all know no one is supposed to know what a Supreme Court decision is until it's announced. We do not know what Tawney told Buchanan. But we now know, because historians have found the letters, that both Justice Catron and Justice Greer had extensive correspondence with Buchanan, and Buchanan knew exactly what the decision was going to be. And in fact, Catron had written to Buchanan asking Buchanan to pressure Justice Greer, who was also from Pennsylvania and was also an old Buchanan buddy, to pressure Greer to sign on to the majority opinion. So we in fact know that Buchanan interfered with the court. The court, at least two justices, maybe Taney as well, told Buchanan what was going on. And he knew this months before his inaugural address. He knew this in February. So when he gets up and says, we'll all do whatever the court says, he knows what the court is going to say. So now, finally, what does the court say? The first thing Taney does is to talk about the jurisdictional question. Now, at one level, this is curious. Remember that plea and abatement way, way back in 1854? You forgot all about it already, right? Well, the plea and abatement was that Dred Scott can't sue because he's not a citizen of Missouri. The judge overruled the plea and abatement. The case went forward. No one, of course, appeals the plea and abatement. Sanford doesn't appeal because he won the whole case. He appeals nothing. You know, you don't win a case and then say, oh, but I want to appeal a procedural thing that I lost. You win, you shut up, you go home, you're happy. Dred Scott doesn't appeal the plea and abatement because that's the only thing he won in the lower court. But Taney, nevertheless, drags up the plea and abatement, and historians have long debated whether Taney had any right to drag it up. What do you think? Does the Chief Justice have a right to ask whether he has jurisdiction to hear the case?
Yes.
Absolutely, right? That's the very first thing a court has a right to say is, do I have jurisdiction over this matter? And so Taney is perfectly correct in saying that we have to revisit the plea and abatement. And in revisiting the plea and abatement, what does he say? The question is simply this. Can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States, and as such become entitled to all the rights and privileges and immunities guaranteed by that instrument to the citizen, one of which is the privilege of suing in court of the United States? And then Taney goes on to say, in discussing this question, we must not confound the rights of citizenship, which a state may confer within its own limits, and the rights of citizenship as a member of the Union. It does not by any means follow, because he has all the rights and privileges of a citizen of a state, that he must be a citizen of the United States. He may have all the rights and privileges of a citizen of a state and yet not be entitled to the rights and privileges of a citizen to any other state. This is a bizarre notion in a constitution where the only definition of citizenship is through the states. However, the way he asks the questions, you know what the answer is going to be. Blacks are not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution, and therefore can claim none of the rights and privileges of that instrument that it secures to citizens. On the contrary, they were at that time, 1787, considered as a subordinate and inferior class of beings who had been subjugated by the dominant race, and whether emancipated or not, yet remained subject to their authority and had no rights or privileges but such as those who held the power and government might choose to grant them. And then in language that still haunts the Constitution, he says, blacks were so inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Now, this, to my way of thinking, is the most impressive example of a jurisprudence of original intent that you can find. And I'm always astounded when members of the Supreme Court argue for a jurisprudence of original intent, because, of course, this is exactly what Taney is doing. He is going back to 1787, and he's saying, what was the intent of the framers? The intent of the framers was that black people can't be citizens. Therefore, they can never be citizens. Therefore, he can't sue. Now, in a very long dissent, a dissent that's even longer than Taney's very long opinion, Justice Curtis of Massachusetts takes Taney to task for being a lousy historian. He says you don't get your history right. He points out that free blacks could vote in 5 or 6 of the original 13 states, that free blacks participated in politics at the time of the Revolution. In fact, by the time the Constitution had been written, free blacks had held public office, at least in New Hampshire and maybe in a couple of other places. So Curtis's argument is that original intent means that they were included. Taney's argument is that original intent shows that they're not. Either way, I think it exposes the problem of trying to use original intent when there's no specific discussion of it in the Constitution.
That brings us to the end of the program today. I hope you found it enlightening. We will conclude this lecture by Professor Paul Finkelman on the Dred Scott decision next week. In the meantime, keep it right here at PRN.FM. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Of course, tomorrow is Friday, so you know, on Lead Stories, it's time to free your mind. So get your brains in gear. Until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your esteemed company. Bye-bye.
This is the skeleton which stands here before you. These are the muscles that move the bone. These are the veins that the world's blood runs through.